All right, I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 9:06 a.m. on Friday, March 25th. Members present are everybody. We have Representative Strage and Co-Chair Fields joining us via telephone. We have Representatives Kaufman, McCarty, Nelson, and Snyder here in the room with myself, Chair Sponholz. Thank you so much to our Secretary Leah Fraser, who is joining us remotely, and our LIO moderator, Lydia Klein, for joining us today. Reminder to members and those that are calling in, if you're on the telephone, to announce yourself before speaking so everybody knows who they're talking to. If you haven't already, this is a great time to silence your cell phones. Today, we have one big meaty topic on our agenda, and that is an informational hearing on affordable housing in Alaska. And we're going to hear from several stakeholders and experts on the topic with the intention of potentially taking up a committee bill on the topic of affordable housing moving forward. We're going to hear today in this order from Mark Rumick with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Meg Zalatel with the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, Michelle Brown with the Rasmussen Foundation, Colleen Dushkin with the Alaska Association of Housing Authorities, Carol Gore with Cook Inlet Housing Authority, and Andre Spinelli with the Alaska State Home Building Association and Spinell Homes. So with that, we're going to dive into the hearing, and we're going to start with Mr. Rumick. Mr. Rumick, you online? Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Great thing. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committees. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. My name is Mark Rumick. I am the Deputy Executive Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I've been with AHFC for about 30 years now. And since we just celebrated our 50th anniversary last year, that's given me the privilege of witnessing about 60% of our corporation's history. And done a lot of things over that time. And I want to provide a couple comments about some of the things that we're doing and also talk a little bit about the state of the housing market as we see it right now and some of the challenges, particularly for in the affordable housing space. I think as many people know, the mission of Alaska Housing is providing housing for all Alaskans. We do that through a number of different programs, single-family home ownership programs and multifamily housing as well. We touch a lot of different groups of people. Seniors, families, persons with disabilities, and the homeless. We have offices in 16 communities around the state. We manage about 1,600 units of physical property, and we serve about 5,000 families every single night in our Housing Choice Voucher Program. We have approximately 14,000 mortgages, and we have paid back the state close to slightly over $2 billion in dividends over the history of the organization. In terms of looking at what's happening with the organization right now, we also have a number of programs that help nonprofits, for-profits, and community groups build affordable housing. And right now, we have about 800 units of rental housing in production across the state with a variety of different groups through our teacher housing program, senior housing program, and our other rental development programs. As some people know, the vast majority of AHFC's budget comes from the federal government, and so a lot of the programs that we operate are funded with federal funds. Right now, I think the big effort for us is the Emergency Rental Assistance Program that we're operating with ARPA funds on behalf of ourselves, the state, regional housing authorities, and the municipality of Anchorage. To date, slightly over $260 million out into the landlord community, which has helped stabilize the rental market, prevent the evictions, and reduce homelessness all over the state. Right now, we're just starting up a homeowner assistance program with ARPA funds, and that is a similar program but targeted towards homeowners, helping those that have been struggling due to loss of income from the pandemic to make their mortgage payments. And that program has just opened up a couple weeks ago. We have over 7,000 applications. The deadline for that program is coming up April 4th. Information, there's a lot of information on our website about that. One of the things that we are trying to do as well is get as much information out to the public as about the program. So we have a lot of information on our website, including a couple of dashboards that we've created showing the performance of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, and coming very soon, another program, the Homeless Stabilization Program, which is another program that the corporation kicked off last month to start helping people get off the street into shelter or into housing throughout the state. We've got about 126 people that have moved from this street and camping into or shelter into more permanent housing, and we're really excited about that. You know, none of these programs that we have would be successful without the partnerships that we have with the nonprofit communities, the for-profit developers, and local governments throughout the state. You know, we can't do it by ourselves, and the partnership that we have with all these groups is really what makes these programs successful. I'd like to turn my comments a little bit now towards just the challenges in the housing industry in general, because I think that you know, as are the affordable housing industry, so to speak, has the same issues that the general housing market does when it comes to developing housing. And you know, there are many different markets around the state. There's regional and local differences in supply and demand, and so not everything. There's different statistics for every single area, and they vary. But in general, I think everybody recognizes that the housing market right now is seeing very strong sales and pricing in the single family market all over the state. I think everybody's probably heard at least anecdotally from a friend or a friend of a friend that they sold their house in one day and got more money than they ever thought they were going to get from it. And on the rental side, before the pandemic, we saw vacancy rates starting to increase, and that those have stabilized at a lower rate across the state. And I think the biggest impact that we've seen thus far in the rental market kind of stabilizing is in Fairbanks, with the influx of the military personnel that has really had a major impact on the rental market and the single family market up in the Fairbanks North Star borough, particularly North Pole. As I said, you know, the housing market and the affordable market, obviously they move together. It doesn't matter if you're a private developer, you know, building high-end homes, or a small apartment owner where you own 1 to 5 units, or a nonprofit building income or rent-restricted units. And that's, I think, what a lot of times people think of as affordable housing, although there is a component of affordable housing which is referred to as naturally occurring affordable housing, which are essentially just small apartments or landlords that own 1 or 2 units in our portfolio, and that happen to be affordable to people. But you know, both of these, it doesn't matter what group you're in, everybody faces the same issues that right now, with cost escalation from increases in land, labor, and a cost of capital, particularly as we enter into a rising interest rate environment. All of the supply chain issues, inflationary pressures that are affecting everybody in the industry are going to be, to a certain extent, exacerbated by the cost of debt as we move forward with what's happening with the Federal Reserve and the change in the interest rates. Clearly, it's more difficult for the private sector, who don't have access to all of the resources that and the nonprofit community might have through government programs. But in particular, for any developer if they're expected to shoulder the, you know, the burden of infrastructure development associated with land development, or the infrastructure costs associated with land development. It makes the gaps that exist in these projects substantially more difficult to overcome. You know, the other issue that that everyone faces, less so probably in the private sector, except for in the area of maybe labor, is the capacity issue. We have an uneven capacity across the state when it comes to the development of housing, and that makes it more difficult, even if there is funding available, to get housing placed in various communities. If there's nobody that is skilled in developing housing in from that community. I think that nonprofits face a different challenge in the sense that, you know, oftentimes the government funding they do access comes with a certain degree of management complexity, which is not really for the faint of heart. You know, you go into those programs with good intentions and realize that it is a little bit more difficult given the rules that come down with the sources of funding. And as I said before, you know, many of these problems existed before the pandemic, and the pandemic has really just exacerbated some of them. But I think that you know, these challenges have create a number of opportunities, and I think to a large extent, some of the communities have already embraced those challenges and are working towards addressing them. You know, communities, I think in general across the state, are trying very hard to use the full flexibility that they have to incentivize development in both the unrestricted and the restricted housing markets. You know, specific tools that you may have read about or heard about, like tax abatements, development of accessory dwelling units, which, if you're not familiar with those, are often referred to as ADUs, or sort of like mother-in-law apartments that are added to people's homes or on their land. Streamlining of permitting building regulations, offering density bonuses, outright capital investments, land donations or leases, you know, are all examples of what communities are doing across the state to try to address some of the challenges of affordable housing and regular housing development. You know, even with these tools, there's still some financing gaps that do exist. I think, you know, recently the municipality of Anchorage released a downtown development plan where they identified a number of great examples of how expensive it is to build in downtown Anchorage, and where the gaps exist, even if you provide full tax abatements and discounted land. You know, I think it's even with those challenges, they've been able to work out a number of partnerships. And I think there was just yesterday there was an announcement from ACDA about a new housing development that's going to be is breaking ground this spring in downtown Anchorage. It's going to produce 48 units of unrestricted apartments. It's going to be one of the first private deals, I think, done in Anchorage in a very long time. You know, I think that, you know, I spent a lot of time talking about challenges and whatnot, but I think that, you know, I just want to end with saying that HFC has been around for a long time, and we've always been a willing partner in these efforts to produce more housing across the state, whether it be affordable housing or regular housing. And, you know, we welcome any opportunity that we can to talk to people about the programs that we have, how they will work, what the challenges might be, and how they're being used right now successfully across the state to produce housing. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm available for questions now or at the other end of the presentation at your discretion.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Romick?
I'd like to save it till later.
Okay. All right. Looks like there's no questions for you right now. Hang on. In the eventuality there are additional questions, I think that's a possibility. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Meg Zalatel, who's the Interim Executive Director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. Ms. Zalatel, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to the committee for having me. I have a few slides, and I believe Ms. Ward-Waller has them to share.
They're up on the screen.
Fantastic. So if we can just move right on to the next slide. I'm going to jump So the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness is the...
I apologize. Uh-huh. There's a formality. You have to officially introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Thanks. I'm Meg Zalato. I'm the Interim Executive Director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. The Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness is the continuum of care organization as designated by HUD. That means we plan the geographic homeless prevention response system in Anchorage. We do have a counterpart at the balance of state. So Anchorage does its own planning, but of course statewide issues affect what happens in Anchorage. So jumping right into the affordable housing question, I like to start with saying housing is the solution to homelessness. However, as we can see from the Alaska rents comparison here, housing is hard to obtain in Anchorage, particularly affordable housing, and actually all across the state. It takes approximately $23.74 for an hourly wage to be able to rent a two-bedroom apartment. If you're working minimum wage, you're looking at 92 hours a week of work. So that's a significant hurdle to affordable housing in Alaska. Next slide, please.
All right, there's a question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair to Ms. Salto. The $23.74 required to afford a two-bedroom rental home, is that just for one person working, not splitting the rent up or anything like that?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so if it...
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if someone were to say, you know, have a two-bedroom rental apartment or rental home, and they were to get roommates or something to lower the cost, that would significantly reduce, correct?
Yes, that is correct. I think, though, when you're looking at a two-bedroom rental home, or you take this in the context of a family, you are looking at additional complicating factors such as childcare if there are children. But yes, if you had two roommates working and they were sharing the two bedroom, you could divide that in half. However, that would still be above minimum wage.
I just want to double check. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
So if we move to the next slide, this is an Anchorage-based breakdown, and I realize you are all considering this on a statewide basis, but the reason I like to provide this Anchorage-based breakdown is you can see the variation even among zip codes in a locality. And I can provide through this committee the website where you can actually put in different zip codes and see what those rents would look like. It does vary significantly. You see the Chugiak Eagle River rent at approximately $35.19, whereas over by the airport in Anchorage, $22.69. That's quite a variation. Next slide, please.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair to Ms. Alto. Looking at the northern Anchorage section, especially 99506, that looks to be majority, about 90%, just initial looks, out on the military base. I'm just wondering about those numbers because the military personnel don't pay for their housing when they're on post.
Through the chair to Representative Nelson, yes, that is correct. This is a national website that aggregates data. So my guess is that they have the cost that it costs the military to provide the housing, but we could get further clarification if you would like.
That would be perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And we'll share that with the committee when we get that information. Representative McCarty?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The email, pardon me, the website, if you just be stated.
Oh, yeah, sure. So if you can follow up in an email, Ms. Zalatal, with the link to the website and the information about whether or not military housing is included, and if so, how, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely, Madam Chair.
And we will distribute that to the committee. So.
Okay, thank you. The next slide is around vacancy rates. So you can see here, vacancy rates are tight across the state. Many dropped in 2021. So looking at, you know, overall, we're at about a 5.9% vacancy rate statewide. However, if you go into different communities, like Anchorage, it's a 4.3% vacancy rate. Anything under 5%, particularly for people experiencing homelessness, becomes a very challenging and competitive market to find housing. Next slide, please.
Excuse me, Representative McCarty has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. With the housing, how much of that has also to do with the increase in Airbnbs that's not calculated into the vacancy rate because it's not a vacancy calculation for a resident?
Thank you. Through the chair, it is a complicating factor. So that vacancy, if it is, I know in Anchorage, if it is paying bed tax, is not considered housing vacancy. So it's not considered in that vacancy rate factor because it is held out as a vacation or short-term rental.
To answer your question, Representative McCarty,
follow up. So do you have any numbers of how much the Airbnb has increased and affected our housing of residents?
What I could do through the chair, what I could do is get the total number of units that are registered for Airbnb and how that's maybe increased. These particular statistics through the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce, I do not know if they did that analysis by community, but we could do it specifically to Anchorage if that was of interest, because Anchorage specifically collects the number of units because that platform pays the bed tax directly.
You follow up?
No follow up. Thank you. Through the chair. So if you could also provide that for the on a year basis like you have here. So I want to see what happened in 19, 21, or 20, 21, increases Airbnb, decrease in resident availability.
Yes.
All right.
Next, please. Next slide, please.
We're there.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I couldn't see.
Sometimes there's a delay in the video stream, so we're looking at the map of Alaska with the permanent supportive housing beds per capita.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the permanent supportive housing beds, and just for a little bit of information, permanent supportive housing beds are housing units or beds provided to people who have often experienced chronic homelessness that have wraparound services so that they can live independently. And we look right now at the beds per 1,000 residents. Anchorage has two per 1,000 residents. Most communities have none. And then Juneau and Mat-Su have between about 1.5 to almost 2. Why this is significant is right now, to put it in some context, we have about 855 individuals in the mass care or the municipally run shelter. A number of those residents, definitely over 150 of them, need permanent supportive housing. As you can see, that's a significant gap. And it's not for lack of identifying a program. There is a program called Home for Good that is working to support these individuals and find housing for them. But finding housing and landlords that will accept an individual who has who's experienced chronic homelessness, who may have a record of incarceration or police interaction, need behavioral health care, wrapping all of those services around an individual and finding a placement for them is extremely difficult. And we just don't have the built-in capacity. So it is very much an independent search Additionally, to bring that bed number up, we have serious workforce development issues. Because obviously you need to understand the clientele, be able to provide those wraparound services for individuals. So this continues to be a significant issue statewide, and a significant issue for Anchorage. Next slide, please. The rapid rehousing is the best tool we have when someone experiences homelessness for the first time. We can rapidly move them into another apartment or another place to live so they do not have to enter shelter or can remain in shelter the bare minimum amount of time. We avoid significant trauma to them. We avoid significant compounding disruptions on their life. But as you can see, the number of rapid rehousing beds is also very low, with no community having even a full rapid rehousing bed per 1,000 residents. This, again, has become very acute in Anchorage as we try to unwind the mass care shelters. There just simply are not enough units to move people into. And it's not for lack of rental assistance in the moment. It is the lack of physical space. It was recently announced that certain non-congregate mass care hotels were going to be closing, and to hurry to find units for individuals is very challenging. And the alternative becomes, when those assets close, is the individuals will have to either move to another non-congregate location or perhaps go to the congregate location at the Sullivan Arena. The best result, of course, is the least number of moves and into housing.
Representative McCarty has a question.
Thank you. To the chair, going to both of these maps that were given, so use an example of Anchorage and the calculations there, that it seems to appear, if I'm doing the math correctly, that there's 600 beds for the necessary people that are without beds in Anchorage. And then looking at the second map, your statement of rapid rehousing, what calculations are you doing for those people that have family, as example, that have beds for them, but they also have boundaries for them, and these people are not wanting to follow the boundaries, like not doing drugs, and they're homeless because they're choosing to not comply with a family norm?
Thank you for the question through the chair. So when we talk about rehousing, we often talk about what is available for a client based on client choice and independent housing. Now, if a client chooses to reunite with family and wants to live with family and follow the rules, then that is their choice. But there is no factor built into this in terms of being able to rehouse with family or a roommate. Those are often client choice issues. What we saw, though, is that those options are very tenuous. When something like COVID-19 came, a lot of those we call those informal safety nets and often informal resolutions, they fell away. Doubling up, couch surfing, living in an informal arrangement, because they're not necessarily a part of that core family unit. They wouldn't be considered necessarily the family for purposes of housing. So your traditional definitions of family, whether it's you're going to go stay with an aunt or a close friend. So these numbers don't take into account those particular arrangements or those relationships. However, as we do look to rehouse individuals as they come into the homeless prevention response system, we do explore those options with them.
And Ms. Zalatel, it's my understanding that most homeless folks in Alaska are, in fact, already in informal relationships. And what we're talking about, for the most part, are people that don't have access to those informal relationships through family or friends or things like that. Can you describe that for us?
Yes, Madam Chair. So those informal relationships often involve multiple people experiencing homelessness. We do see sometimes if a person does resolve to housing, whether or not that housing can accommodate any of those informal family situations that they have developed. However, it is a barrier as well. Some individuals experiencing homelessness do not want to be housed without their family members if they're these informal structures. Right now, as we look to house a significant number of individuals out of mass care, one of the conversations we're having with HUD, Housing and Urban Development, that's here providing technical assistance, is how can we facilitate roommate agreements and other ways to create some structure and formality so that everyone in those in that situation that chooses to move into a housing unit is protected.
All right, thank you. And I'll just add that my experience prior to serving in the legislature was working at the Salvation Army, and we actually administered some of the rapid rehousing funding and many homeless programs. And you know, most folks, it was the experience of the folks running the social services programs was that most people that are homeless in Alaska are living with, you know, a relative or a friend or you know, former neighbor or something like that. And what we're talking about for the most part right now are people for whom those relationships won't work. You know, we've all taken in somebody when they didn't have housing, a friend or a neighbor or a relative at some point in time. But what we're talking about are folks for whom that's not an option or for whom it's not a long-term option. So I think that's important. For example, in the Child in Need of Transition program in Anchorage, most of the people at the Child in Need of Transition, and those are the homeless kids in Anchorage, they're in somebody's apartment or house, but they are not in their apartment or house. They're in somebody else's, for example. So that's what I was trying to get out there. Just help people understand there's a much bigger problem of homelessness that is already being addressed informally. So there's not more capacity for informal solutions for the most part. What we're talking about are people for whom those solutions won't work. I think that's an important thing to clarify. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I completely agree. And we can move to the next slide, please. So really looking at this, right now I'm putting the single adult lens on this conversation. And so the single adult homeless prevention response system, this is our system, everything from prevention to housing. And what I use this slide to illustrate is that there's a continuum of services to respond to homelessness, including several paths to housing. In some ways, we've talked about some of those, about finding an informal resolution, some way to live with a friend or a family member, but we're also exploring housing, like workforce supportive housing around a hotel conversion in Anchorage. We need the units. So these will not look like the apartments you might think of it when you think of an apartment. This will be what we call a single room occupancy. And what's really come to light as we're trying to unwind mass care and create this expanded homeless prevention response system is that hotels have actually played a key role in housing individuals in Anchorage for a long time. It's just never been terribly formalized. And so as we look at ways that we can expand the system to accept the additional need, looking to what's already been used, but maybe formalizing those. And then what also we wanted to point out here is the landlord housing partnership, really finding a way to collect the units on the private market that will consider renting to people experiencing homelessness and what supports those landlords' need as well as what supports the client's need. So we're not changing the system as we respond in this moment and in these challenges, but what we are trying to do is enhance it and increase the number of options in the areas that already exist.
All right, thank you. And I just want to note for the committee and our future testifiers that we're running a smidge long right now, so we're going to try to scoot along expeditiously so we can make sure we get to everybody. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next slide, and I can wrap pretty quick.
Great.
So the next slide is just a summary of the challenges and the responses. So challenge, vacancy rate, how do we respond to it? Diversify the types of housing and the way we think about housing. There's a lack of affordable units. Let's leverage this rental assistance and federal relief to create affordable housing units and find sustainable ways forward. It's not, you know, it's difficult to put together a capital stack to bring more units on. It's more difficult to bring on an operating stack to support those housing programs. finding owners for these projects is really difficult, partly because maintenance and operation funding isn't often built in, as well as, you know, that operating stack is really hard to make pencil. And then we have this immediacy of need. The need of, you know, is really quite acute. It's acute across the state. In Anchorage, there are 855 individuals who need a place to go by the end of June. One way to address that is public-private partnerships. And I think Anchorage has really demonstrated some of that work through the facilitated process that's happening in Anchorage, where the coalition, philanthropy, the assembly, and the mayor's office are at the table working these problems together, and not just working solutions, but then working on the capital side and the operating side together. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that presentation today, Ms. Zalatel. We appreciate your time today, as well as your service as the interim executive director at the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. It's great to have you today. All right, looks like there's no questions. We're going to go up now to Michelle Brown, who's a senior fellow with Rasmussen Foundation. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Brown.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Michelle Brown, senior fellow at the Rasmussen Foundation. And Ms. Zalatel covered a number of points I was going to make, so I will be able to tighten some for you, Madam Chair. The Rasmussen Foundation has invested about $50 million over the last 15 years into housing, and increasingly so in recent years. This has been housing for seniors, families, people with disabilities, and in places where there have not been new housing built for decades. More recently, we have been focused on enriched service, enriched housing, for supportive housing on some of our most vulnerable residents. As Ms. Zalatel said, this is an acute area of shortage. But I would like to emphasize that we do this because we know that housing is the bedrock of community safety, stability, health, and economic development. And I want to stress that this is not just a problem for very low income or homeless people. This includes workforce housing. Far too many of Alaska's most common, important, and prevalent jobs do not make enough money to afford housing right now. A recent Anchorage Economic Development Corporation survey, business survey, indicated a growing correlation between the difficulty in attracting and retaining a workforce and the housing shortage. So in short, the lack of supply and the cost of housing is a barrier to housing our workforce, preventing homelessness, reducing overcrowding, and creating opportunities for us to have people exit shelters. The high cost of development, renovation, and maintenance is also affecting our construction industry and costing the state jobs, because new projects just cannot pencil out to what the market can afford to pay in rent. So you've heard a lot of facts and figures, and you'll probably be hearing more. And I'd just like to take this moment to ask us to consider taking a bit of a step up and a broader view. We have all, it's funders, the state, local communities, been approaching this issue on a project by project, program by program, grant by grant basis. We most definitely need all these projects and we need all these grant sources, but it's proving insufficient to address the current scale of the problem and the major impact the lack of housing and the lack of affordable housing is having on our communities. And much of this is due to reasons that are beyond the control of those who are trying to build and operate funding, yet they're the ones who have the burden of trying to go from place to place to get funding for both capital and operations. I think I would like to recommend that the time is right now and commend this committee for having this conversation, for us to come together and analyze what other tools we might as a state deploy that could help us very intentionally increase the availability and the affordability of housing across the entire state. There are many tools that have already been tested elsewhere that we could explore and tailor to Alaska. These tools could help us create a policy and an economic infrastructure that could help our communities better address increasing housing stock of all types through partnerships with communities, developers, providers, funders, and lenders, et cetera. It can start with a very clearly stated goal of we need to increase housing stock by X percent or by a number, and then start working on either new tools and or integrating our existing tools in a way that we really drive development, not just make opportunities for funding available and so on, but actually help people put these projects together. Much like, as Ms. Zalatel stated, the facilitated plan in Anchorage is doing that on a smaller scale. This will need to involve public-private partnerships so that we can align our funding, which for both capital and operations, which would make it much easier for folks to get these projects up and going. One tool that has been proven successful elsewhere is a housing trust that can provide a permanent source of funding for development of, preservation of, and maintenance of housing stock. Alaska is one of three states that doesn't have one. The Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness and the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness are setting one up, and this is an option that will be in front of the legislature for possible funding this session. I would just like to close by saying we at the Rasmussen Foundation stand ready to assist in the research of the tools that might help us increase housing stock, might help us align our action and our funding so that it can be far less burdensome for the people who are trying to do this on-the-ground work to increase housing stock and the affordability of that stock. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions from Ms. Brown? Ms. Brown, it looks like nobody else has a question. I do. You said there's only three states that don't have a housing trust, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about housing trust work and what, you know, capitalization would need to look like for that to be effective.
Yes. Housing trust is being established now at the Alaska Community Foundation, and it will become a renewable resource that can top off projects that might otherwise fail to come to fruition because they just can't get enough funding. Uh-huh. It would be quasi-endowed, so it would be in perpetuity a source of funding, and it has proven successful in other states at enabling folks to finish up the capital stack or get to operations that they need to be able to increase the stock and keep the available stock in good condition.
All right. So there's an endowment that's being created at the Alaska Community Foundation to complement capital projects for housing in Alaska. I think one of the other things that we're looking at in the committee would be right now the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is responsible for producing a dividend to the state of Alaska. And given our, you know, the high price of oil that we've got right now, I'm not sure that the modest dividend that the HFC provides to the state, sort of pencils out in when we continue to have this housing gap. What's your opinion on, having those dedicated funds from, you know, the dividend that would be produced by HFC going to address our housing shortage, and how would you recommend we approach that?
Sorry, I have not studied the suggested legislation, but we know that if we set a goal of how many housing units we need and we intentionally start aligning our funding sources and our activities to make sure we get there, not just make programs available generally for, you know, anyone to apply, but very intentionally set that goal, the steady revenue stream is absolutely essential to make that work and to match other investments to bring these projects to life.
All right, thank you. And we've got a question from Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, for Ms. Brown, do we have, I wonder, a list, a line of sight of all the various organizations that are engaged in trying to address, you know, the spectrum of issues around housing?
Through the chair, it depends how you define the issue. There are housing providers, there are service providers that need housing units, there are health providers, there are so many different entities that touch this issue, that I don't know that there's a definitive, response. There certainly are public housing authorities that you're going to hear from soon that may have better data for you.
Follow up. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I guess what I'm looking for is of those that are, let's say, seeking to, you know, create or find housing for individuals or families, kind of in that specific bandwidth.
I do not, through the chair, I do not have a number for you on that. Perhaps some of the other speakers do, but I do not. I can see what I can find for you, though.
Follow up. No, mm-hmm. Thank you, through the chair. I guess what one of the things that I would like to see as we explore this issue is the efficiency, the organizational efficiency, how much overhead we create versus how many units we create. Sometimes the big hand of government coming in with money, we can inflate things without meaning to, and we can create additional bureaucracy that doesn't end up in actually getting, you know, closing in on the goal that we want. So I guess one of the things I would like to see as we explore this, and I'll be repeating this, I'm sure, over time, is that what we're looking at doing is actually organizationally efficient and doesn't get eaten up in overhead or, you know, just bureaucratic process, that it's efficient in terms of creating the actual housing that we may need and doing so without market distortion or inflation. Thank you.
May I respond, Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I think you raise a very good and interesting point, and that's one of the reasons why I spoke about integrating all of our efforts. Is one of the reasons overhead is often high is because the way people acquire funding is they have to go to so many funding sources. They have to do so many applications. They have to go through so much process to get things done that it does require staff to do that work. And if we as funders, state funders, private funders, could ease that burden, we could ease some of that overhead as well. So it's a chicken and the egg, but you raise a really good point of making sure that we are integrated. And oftentimes the dots are not connected among funders, providers, and so on, that creates additional overhead that can be alleviated.
All right. And Representative Snyder has a question.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. I doubt that my question will address a significant component of the issues that we've addressed today, but reflecting on a committee meeting just yesterday on the tourism industry and appreciating the fact that we have significant amount of jobs or positions associated with the seasonality of tourism in Alaska, and we see huge upticks in non-residents coming in to work in these jobs who will need a place to stay while they are here. To what degree does that impact or affect our housing availability in Alaska?
Through the chair, the pressures that are put on by these additional folks on the limited vacancies is palpable, at least in Anchorage. That's all I can speak to. Because when we are trying right now to house people coming out of the mass care at the Sullivan Arena and hotels, if a landlord has a choice between someone who's got a clear job and a good rental history and someone coming out of the Sullivan Arena, we can't compete to get these units. So that does every year depress the units that are available. It also depresses the hotel rooms that we can try to rent.
All right. Do you have anything else you wanted to add, Ms. Brown?
No, thank you all very much.
All right. Thanks so much for your testimony today. I have a question before we move on to Ms. Dishkin. I want to go back up to Mr. Romick. I believe he's still on the line. Mr. Romick, I've got two questions for you. I'll give you a second to get your video back on. All right. Thank you so much. I have two questions for you. One is, can you talk about your what is your administrative overhead for operating AHFC?
Well, I can't give you a specific number in the sense that our entire operating budget includes both our public housing development as well as our mortgage operations, finance, you know, all of our background, everything like that. What I can tell you is that when we administer programs, particularly from the federal government, we're limited on how much admin we can charge to 10% or less. On some of the programs that we do administer, we've used very little admin because we fit the work activity within our existing staff. So, I can't give you a precise answer, but I would certainly get back to you on that if you want to know exactly what our, you know, corporate-wide overhead is on specific programs or across the board.
Yeah, no, I think that the corporate-wide overhead and by program might be helpful. Can you tell us how much of a dividend AHFC produces to the state of Alaska every year?
Sure. In FY 22, it was $42 million. For FY 23, it'll be closer to $22 million due to the issues that are happening in the financial world. Based on the formula that's in statute, that was the dividend calculation for FY 23.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right, Representative McCarty has a question.
Through the chair, the question is actually this global question because I heard that maybe some of you might be leaving, and I don't want you to leave without hearing the question. Question is, it's like watching over the several years internationally as well as in our country and then in our state of the housing issue is not just an Alaska thing. And asking entities all around what's going on in your community, why is the housing going up? The cost of living is still staying the same, but the income is still the same, but the housing is exponentially going up. So that same house, but maybe is purchased at $250,000 now, is $450,000. Same house, it just has gone up. Hearing people that are selling their farm, thinking they've made a bunch of cash, but realizing they can't live in that neighborhood anymore. And now they have to move to a distance area where the job that doesn't exist or they're having to commute. And so it's created a number of different challenges, which also I'm hearing is the funding of it. We're funding people for houses that are now stayed at $450,000 where they before 2 years ago was $250,000. And I'm wondering who's has the skin in the game to have the collateral for the funding and concerned that it's the feds that it's bottom line saying that we could do this, but yet the reality is we're just funding things and just increasing the rates and then creating this false economy and hearing from funders, from realtors, concerned that this bubble is about to burst. So
that is a very big question we might not be able to unpack fully, Representative
McCurdy.
Anybody
could add to, as they testified, Mark, if you could share your thoughts of this piece here.
Well, I think through the chair, Representative McCarthy, you know, I don't think I have a definitive answer that, as the chair mentioned, we could get to within the time allowed. But I think that there's a lot of things that are in play as it relates to why housing is increasing as rapidly as it is, from financial markets to, demand by the individuals. So I'm not sure that I can provide much more detail right than that, if that's okay. I'd certainly get back to you with a little bit more definitive answer. It's a much longer answer than I could probably give you right now.
Thank you. That is a very big question. And Mr. Merck, I wanted to ask you as well if you could send us your testimony earlier in writing. There was a lot of great data in there that was really helpful about what AHSC does the scope and of your services and the volume. That I think would be really nice for the committee, and we'll be sure to distribute that to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if you could indulge me for just one second, I do have some information that I could address the previous question about bed and breakfast in relationship to the vacancy rate survey. The vacancy rate, if it's okay, the vacancy rate survey is produced by the Department of Labor under contract to Alaska Housing, and so I can specifically tell you that the vacancy rates that are calculated in that survey pertain to only private housing. So it's people who are on the registers or on the lists of municipalities as owning housing. It doesn't go out to affordable housing providers like the regional housing authorities. We don't fill it out. It does not include any bed and breakfasts or Vrbos or anything like that. The units have to be available for rent to the general public in order to be included in the survey.
Okay, so it excludes Airbnbs and bed and breakfasts and things like that. All right, that's helpful. Thank you so much for that answer. Appreciate that. All right, with that, we're going to go up to Ms. Colleen Dishkin, and we're going to try to continue to scoot along here. Thanks so much for your time today. It's great to see you. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Co-Chair Fields and Sponholz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colleen Dishkin, and I have the pleasure of serving as the Executive Director for the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony today. And Co-Chair Sponholz, if it's okay, before I get into my formal comments, I would like to just briefly mention some of the question to Ms. Valatel. I wanted to expand a little bit about what homelessness looks like in our rural communities. And really, it manifests as overcrowded conditions. And it's actually interesting to hear that I've never heard the term informal relationship before. So that's an interesting concept that I'd like to dig into. But in our rural communities, the homelessness is our overcrowded population. And I'll get into data further down in my testimony. But so the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities, our members include 14 regional housing authorities, and they provide affordable housing development and services to 196 tribes in Alaska. Working with local, state, and federal partners, housing authorities are the only developers of affordable housing in most of our rural communities. Their partners, they also partner to develop community facilities such as child care centers, community halls, and homeless shelters. The housing authorities were established by state statute in the 1970s, and they've been providing these services in every corner of the state. They're the boots on the ground and deeply rooted in their communities and families. As sole practitioners that develop affordable housing at a rate comparable to none other in the state, the RHAs have the capacity. We've talked a little bit about capacity, Mark did, but the RHAs have the capacity to build and develop housing in the most remote areas in our state. And they're doing this with scarce resources. Housing authorities have been doing the work for over 50 years, and half of that time was under the 1937 Housing Act, which shoehorned Indian housing and public housing. For the past 25 years, they've been working under the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act. It's referred to as NAHASDA. And NAHASDA recognized and empowered tribal self-determination so the housing authorities and tribes can deploy assistance to Native communities. And really, what does this mean? It means that HUD no longer prescribed what we were building and where. So our homes were no longer constructed in the lower 48 without consideration to how they'd last in our climate. We have freezing cold, sideways rain, hurricane force winds. None of that was considered in this old housing model. So that's how it worked prior to NAHASDA. And it's important to think about these homes are what makes up the vast majority of our current stock in our rural communities. You've probably seen photos and talked to families in our communities about their homes being decayed and dilapidated. They weren't meant for here, which is, you know, why weatherization is important, by the way. Up until FY22 appropriations were passed as its federal funding in March, NAHASDA has been flat funded. So for nearly 25 years since NAHASDA was enacted in 1996, funding has been flat from the federal government. So not only has it been flat, it actually has eroded by over 30%. This isn't taking into consideration the continual rise in transportation, material costs, or the historic inflation rate of 4.9% that we've seen in 2021. As you may know, the cost of construction has skyrocketed with increased cost to labor and materials. We hear some of our housing authorities talking about housing packages that have increased by $70,000 per home in one region. We hear the housing authorities in another region talking about to drill pilings for a foundation. In 2018, it was $36,000 per home. Today, it's $103,000 per home. So talking about, you know, getting to the root of some of the increase in cost, these are real-time information that can help kind of paint the picture of what we're looking at in real time. So regional housing authorities face growing need and an increase of housing disparities. And even with these challenges, they work to increase the supply of safe, sanitary, and affordable housing. They're essentially doing this with less funding every year because of inflation. It's important to note that NAHASDA, the legislation, received a little bit of funding to respond to COVID, but that funding bump didn't even, it made up for about 1 year of inflation. You know, the committee has likely discussed at length the historic once in a generation, very exciting bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed in Congress. What did Congress miss in the infrastructure bill? Housing. There's a direct correlation between housing and infrastructure. Water, sewer, transportation, broadband. Yeah, these are essential infrastructure needs in communities, but they connect homes and families, another essential piece of a community's infrastructure. There was requests about data, and I'm going to go into a little bit of data from the AHFC 2018 housing assessment. That has shown that over 12,600 homes are without complete plumbing and kitchens. That's always a health concern, but with COVID, it enhanced the needs to wash our hands more often. Difficult to do when you don't have running water. More than 14,000 homes are very inefficient. This is resulting in our families having to pay a lot more money to heat their homes. With the rising fuel costs, our families in rural communities are really going to feel this impact more than ever. In some regions, nearly 40% of homes are overcrowded or severely overcrowded. Coach Sponholz, just back to that point about these are our homeless individuals and families in our communities. More than 16,000 homes need to be developed just to alleviate this overcrowding. You don't need to be a PhD and have all the knowledge in the world to understand why the YK was hit so hard with COVID. Lack of running water, overcrowded conditions. These are a recipe for the spread of a respiratory illness. Another startling statistic that I'd like to bring forward and talk about is, or mention is that by 2030, our senior population is expected to double. And again, this is going back to 2018. We'll need 300 additional senior living facility beds to keep up with population growth. What seemed like a number that's way far in the future is a short 8 years away. The needs are great, but the opportunity for the state of Alaska to be it, the needs are great, but so is the opportunity for the state to be part of the solution. The state's investment in the programs that the housing authorities access and trust are through the capital budget that appropriates funding for four key programs that I'll touch on a little bit through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I'll just briefly touch on teacher, health professional, and public safety program, which I'll call professional housing, the senior housing development grant program, the weatherization program, and the supplemental housing development grant program. First, the professional housing program is critical to ensuring that our communities have the housing available for our professionals. It allows for our communities to have the necessary workforce to keep our families safe. It also cuts down on costly turnover and turnover that has deep social impacts in our communities. This program in particular is a matching grant fund, but it's also often a debt service for the housing development. So they produce loans. And moving forward, as our senior population is projected to double, you know, having adequate, appropriate housing for our elders to age in place and to have a place of their own is critical for our communities. The Senior Housing Development Grant Program is a leveraging tool that the housing authorities use to develop these units across the state. The weatherization program, we all know, is an amazing program, but it's critical for preserving the aging stock in our communities. Like I had mentioned before, before Nahasa had said, this is your home, we're going to put it here, and we don't know what it's going to do. The weatherization program extends the life of substandard homes and that might be on the brink of being uninhabitable. And when we lose that aging housing stock, it compounds the overcrowding conditions in our community. So the families that are in those homes that come to a point that they can't inhabit are dispersed amongst the rest of the units in the communities, which then increase the overcrowding. Finally, the Supplemental Housing Development Grant Program invests in our communities. It requires a 5-to-1 match, or the funds can't be more than 20% of the total development. The housing authorities often leverage this program 8-to-1. As mentioned before, the committee has probably spoke at length about the infrastructure bill, and housing is a missing piece of that legislation. The Supplemental Housing Development Grant Program provides a mechanism to deploy infrastructure-like projects, electrical distribution, civil work, among other eligible activities. I think most importantly, the regional housing authorities have historically used the Supplemental Housing Development Grant Program to start to build a capital stack, and that really makes projects feasible across the state. So working closely with our partners at AHFC, housing authorities have been extremely successful. They have the capacity to deploy these programs that are appropriated through the capital budget. And so in closing, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Fields, and members of the committee, we all know safe and affordable housing for our families is necessary to thrive and to contribute to a sustainable community. But our communities lack this need. We know that housing is the nucleus of all communities and contributes to positive educational, health, economic outcomes. The housing authorities that comprise AHA membership, we welcome the state's partnership to invest in safe and affordable housing in all of our communities. So, Kugasakong, thank you, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We really appreciate it. And we're actually going to hold questions at this point in time. We've still got two testifiers, and I want to make sure we get through everybody. I apologize to the committee for running long. All right, next up we're going to go to Carol Gore. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Gore?
Good morning. My name is Carol Gore, and I have the privilege of serving as the president and CEO for Cook Inlet Housing located here in Anchorage. I want to thank Representative Sponholz and Representative Fields for the invitation to provide testimony on the topic of housing. That's not the usual, and I appreciate that you've stepped out of the usual box to invite us into the conversation. Thank you for noticing also that housing was not included in the federal infrastructure package. I think that's truly unfortunate. To me, housing is our state's biggest opportunity. We know firsthand, from tribal leaders to mayors to employers to our workforce, that housing is a top priority in every community in Alaska. Without adequate and affordable housing, employers can't attract and retain their critical workforce. Families, seniors, and young professionals are leaving Alaska because they can't find housing. Rural communities face unbelievable overcrowding that means children, seniors, and adults don't have a healthy environment to live, learn, or work. No matter the social or economic topic, the lack of housing in Alaska is Alaska's biggest barrier. To me, there is no more important investment for Alaskans and no better economic investment for Alaska than housing. Cook Inlet Housing has been developing and managing multifamily housing primarily in the last 20 years. We build in Anchorage, but we have partnered with others to build housing in Wasilla, Palmer, and Hoover Bay. We're also a proud member of the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities, and I'm just super proud of Colleen Dishkin's testimony and proud of the data that she put on the table, so I'm not going to restate what she said. But the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities is a place where we share, as housers, experience, knowledge, and challenges. We provide solutions, and you would see a lot of innovation in that group of people. I have the deepest respect for my peers who build in rural Alaska. They build in some of the most difficult-to-build communities, and they're doing it without the investment of a private market. While Anchorage's challenges may be different than other communities, we recognize there is a need for housing for all of our communities in order for our state to be healthy and economically viable. We need affordable housing for our workforce, our seniors, and those who are most vulnerable that need supported or special purpose housing. And yes, we need market housing too. That's to my friend Andre, who is next on your schedule. The lack of investment in housing over decades has put us behind, and at our current funding levels, we just can't catch up. Let me give you a current example. In 2021, there were only 51 multifamily homes permitted in the municipality of Anchorage, and CHOP permitted them all. We reviewed 400 applications for these 51 apartments. We're proud of our work, but we can't meet the need by ourselves, and adding just 51 units a year won't begin to meet that need. Finally, I want to share the state of Anchorage's local housing market and provide a bit of our experience in developing and managing housing in Anchorage. The rental market is very tight. Our portfolio of about 1,800 apartments is sitting at 5% vacancy, and we continue to receive over 175 applications and answer an average of 200 calls every single week. Rents in the private market are up 23%. We hear the private market is at 3% vacancy, and we know there isn't any available housing because our community can't find apartments to place people who want to exit shelters and move into the private market. We just need three basic things to deliver housing, like capacity, and funding. We have the first two, but there's not enough funding to meet the need. On the funding side, we are so lucky to have HFC. In our experience, no significant housing is built in this state without HFC being a partner. We also talk about funding in terms of a capital stack because it can take multiple sources to get to full funding. That means we're leveraging every dollar we get from the state, and I think, to stand corrected if Colleen has a different number, that's a 9-to-1 match. Agency programs exist already. They have policies, staffing, outreach, and credibility. We consider them our strongest partner. Their programs are designed to directly fund construction and not overhead. housing construction alone will not solve the issue of homelessness and keep our vulnerable neighbors stable. If we want to engage landlords, we need funding for case management and support services to keep our most vulnerable housed. We need financial tools that are flexible, that layer and leverage, and that are intended to support the preservation and production of housing. The state's investment in weatherization has helped to preserve the critical housing we have now. That matters when the cost to replace that housing is high. On a personal note, my mom is 92, and I know firsthand how hard it is to find housing for seniors. It's a long search for me, and I am very concerned about not just my mom, but her friends who are facing that same challenge. Bottom line, we need more housing today. Affordable housing has been underfunded for decades, and not just at the state level, but at the federal level. If we don't invest in housing, we risk losing critical workforce, families, and seniors, and the opportunity for healthier, more economically viable communities. I hope this is helpful. We're grateful for your interest, and I'm very happy to answer questions. Thanks for this opportunity.
All right. Thanks so much for your testimony, Ms. Gore. We're going to go ahead and hold questions because we're running so late today. Appreciate your time. And if you could follow up and submit your testimony in writing, we'll make sure to distribute it to the committee. Next up, we're going to go to Andre Spinelli. If you could go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, this is Andre Spinelli. I am a current director and past president of the Anchorage Alaska State Home Builders Association. Can everybody hear me?
Can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'll be brief. I got pulled into this rather late notice, so I don't have a formal presentation. I do have a couple things written down. First, I'll tell you a little bit about the State Home Builders Association. We represent the entire industry, from general contractors to subcontractors, associate members, and suppliers. These are the guys building houses on the private side, as well as many working on some of the cooking the housing or the housing authorities and whoever. So we're involved with all forms of housing. I guess I just kind of real briefly touch on some of the things that I've seen and the challenges for us. Our main challenge at the moment that seems to kind of outweigh all the challenges that, you know, have been mentioned previously is the recent increase in supply costs and the lack shortage of building supplies, with the extremely busy housing market nationwide. Everything has gone up and it just keeps going up. Lumber's the big one that everyone talks about. It probably gets the most amount of press, but we're currently seeing increased pricing for everything. And I went back and checked my pricing just from March of 2019 to March of 2020 to 2021 to today. And we've had a 30% increase in the cost of a house since 2019. And that's really kind of drastic compared to what we've seen for the last 10 years or 15, 20 years previous. So that's our biggest challenge. And then I guess the next thing on my list is the lack of labor. There's just a shortage of labor, and so labor costs are going up. You know, building in Anchorage, we're competing with the workforce in the valley. The valley's building, you know, almost four times as many single family homes per year as Anchorage is, and with the valley getting so busy and the majority of the workforce building houses in Anchorage probably live in the valley. So we're seeing cost increase in labor and shortages of labor. So it's difficult to bring housing on the market. It's slowing down construction time and exacerbating the supply and demand problem we have with housing. And this is not just for Anchorage, but for all housing markets across the state. And then the last thing on my list is just the lack of affordable land and the infrastructure required to bring vacant land online as a developable lot. The the collector roads or water and sewer extensions or other various utilities, those are substantial upfront costs that smaller home builders outside of that, you know, say the Anchorage, Mat-Su, or the larger areas, they don't necessarily have the ability to pony up or qualify for a loan in order to develop land that then they can turn into lots that could eventually supply housing. So though, and even for larger developers here in Anchorage, you know, if I build a subdivision and I have a road with water and sewer, electric and gas in it, you know, between the cost of the land and the cost of that road, it almost equals what a person can afford to pay for a lot to build a house on. So if I had a collector road or a long utility extension that I needed to pay for to get the improvements to that site, then my budget goes out the window. It becomes very difficult, and that slows down the supply of land and eventually available housing. And that's really what we're seeing in the market today, is a lack of supply, and that's raising the cost of housing, like, insanely, I guess that's what I would say. I've been involved with housing my whole life, professionally about 20 years, I guess, 25 years now. So I used to be the guy in the room, but now I can kind of say, like, I've been doing this a long time and I've never quite seen it like this. I can only imagine this was what the early 80s must have been like. But anyhow, I'll stop there. That's all I had, and leave it at that. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks so much. Representative McCarty has a question, and I'm going to be gracious and extend the opportunity, and then we're going to wrap this hearing up.
Thank you, Representative McCarty. Andre, thank you very much for being here. When the contracts were made for the construction of housing, and all of a sudden the supply and demand just, our supply just, you know, diminished, the demand was great, and you and others had agreements for doing housing or building houses and such. I'm hearing some of these owners of these houses and contracts were possibly holding you at bay, where you had to provide for the agreed upon amount. How has that affected the construction or the contractors and developers because of that obligation?
Well, I can't speak for all contractors, because every contract in itself is different based on the terms of that particular contract. And so even, you know, my jobs from one house to the other can be different. But what I can tell you is that I've heard several smaller contractors that might not have this, a similar purchasing power or purchasing agreements that Spinella Homes has, that when lumber started going bananas, you know, 2 years ago, they started putting clauses in their contracts that said, okay, this price is based on this budget for lumber, and we reserve the right to let you know if the budget is not going to work and it needs to go higher to finish the project. Spinella Homes is a kind of a larger contractor, and so we end up, you know, we kind of have a reputation to uphold, and people look at us thinking that we can absorb more, so we try to absorb more. So we've done less of that ourselves and honored most of our contracts, and we haven't been putting those escalation terms in. Although, however, recently, because it sometimes takes 5 months before you start a house from the day you sign the paperwork, we've been adding a term that the final plans and pricing will be agreed upon by both parties at the time construction begins. So we're not guaranteeing prices until we know we're ready to start the project. And that's something new that we have. You know, we used to do it on custom homes and custom designs because you really didn't know what it was going to cost until you finished it. But now we're doing it on every house that we don't think we're going to start within the next 30 days.
Wow. All right. Thank you very much. for everybody. Thanks so much to everybody for your testimony today. I think the committee learned a lot. There's some a lot of opportunities and a lot of challenges. I share, you know, Ms. Dishkin's concern that housing wasn't included in the infrastructure package, and I think that's because they had separated out and were planning on addressing it in another bill that never got passed, and now we continue to have the problem of a shortage of housing in the state of Alaska and in terms of, you know, a dose-related volume related to housing that is challenging. I think this committee is going to work more on this topic. I do want to make a note about House Bill 176, direct care agreements. We'd set an amendment deadline for Sunday night. We are going to extend that time frame out. The committee co-chair's intention is to adopt a committee substitute that incorporates the changes that were recommended by Director Wing Heyer from the Division of Insurance. And then we will, once that committee substitute has been adopted, then we will reset the amendment deadline so that we can make sure that amendments are drafted to the committee substitute. Her changes were substantive enough that it would have restructured the bill pretty dramatically, and we thought we would make sure that there weren't any unintended consequences. And so I just want to be really transparent with everybody about that. So you can slow down on your amendments, and we will take those up at a later date. Our next committee meeting is scheduled for Monday, March 28th at 3:15 p.m. here in Barnes 124. We're going to have a first hearing on House Bill 108 and a presentation on divestment policy. Thanks again to our Secretary Leah Fraser and our LIO moderator Lydia Klein. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 10:32 a.m.